Hello, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us for today's special live stream event, Election Watch After the Convention. It is Monday, August 26th. It is 1 p.m. Eastern time here in New York. So good morning to those of you further west, and good afternoon to everybody on the East Coast and in the middle. I'm Anthony Pastore. I'm delighted to be joined by my CIO colleagues for this discussion, Nadia Lovell, Senior U.S. Equity Strategist, and Tom McLaughlin, the co-lead of Election Watch here at UBS. By the way, we always appreciate hearing from you, our live audience, so we are going to open up the lines. Two questions from you. There is an Ask a Question button right on your screen where you're watching this video, so we'll make sure that you can engage with myself, Nadia, and Tom throughout today's discussion. Of course, we'll get to those questions a little bit later in the show. But I do want to dive right in for the reason that we're here, which, of course, is many of you, I'm sure, watched the Democratic National Convention last week. So, Tom, it wrapped up this past Thursday. Just want to start off with what your main takeaways were from the DNC.
Well, good day, Anthony. It's good to be with you. It was a lot of general enthusiasm for the new national ticket that Democrats have proposed. There was also, I think, a willingness to suppress internal dissension from within. Convention organizers were concerned about the media coverage of expected protests regarding Israel's prosecution of the war in Gaza following the attack by Hamas in October. There were some protests, but they did not rise to the level which distracted the media from the messages that the Democrats wanted to convey, which is one of relative unity. So I guess the main takeaway, and it could still change, is that Vice President Harris has managed to hold a fractious party together based on a couple of things. First, opposition to former President Trump, not a surprise from one party to the other, as well as widespread relief that President Biden did step aside. Biden was given accolades throughout the 4 days of the convention, but the general sense was one of relief following a disastrous debate on June 27th. As far as other observations go, the vice presidential candidates generally don't matter, but Governor Walz might be a critical factor in a Democratic win in the 2nd Congressional District of Nebraska, which is an interesting twist based on early polls. It's just one electoral vote, but it could be a very close election, and it could matter. Based on some early polling after he was announced, the Harris-Walz ticket basically has increased above Trump in that one congressional district. Harris appears to have resuscitated the three constituencies necessary for a Democratic win. Those voters under 30, African-Americans, and college-educated suburban women. Trump's base, on the other hand, is still rock solid at 46% of likely voters, but he is going to need to campaign in person more aggressively than he has thus far if he's going to keep it close or win the election.
Great. Thank you, Tom. I wanted to just kind of let our audience know, since Vice President Kamala Harris has replaced President Biden on the ticket, we see, as you said, the race has certainly tightened up. There's one poll after another. But you and the rest of the team recently revised the CIO's election probabilities. Maybe you can discuss the latest thinking, and we'll pull those numbers up on the screen for our audience to see.
Oh, good. All right. That'll be helpful. Yeah, we did revise the forecast in conjunction with our colleagues in the U.S. Office of Public Policy. So what we've got right now is a 40% probability of Harris winning with a divided Congress and another 15% that she wins in a blue sweep. In other words, a narrow 55% likelihood that Harris wins. Former President Trump's odds are down to 35% with a unified GOP Congress and another 10% where he wins and the Senate goes Republican, but the Democrats flip the House. So basically 45%. And that gives you a sense of how tight we think this election is going to be. It'll still be 55 to 45, something on that order. Another way to look at those odds, there's still a significant chance at 75% that Republicans will take control of the Senate. We have to start with the presumption that West Virginia will go Republican, which is about as close to a mortal lock as you can get. That means that we start going into this, if you take West Virginia as a Republican seat going forward, that means we're at 50-50. And then, of course, the Republicans need to just flip one Senate seat. They have the ability to do so, although I would point out that they, as a consequence of some of the shifts in sentiment over the last 2 or 3 weeks, Democrats are actually doing better in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Nevada, Arizona, Wisconsin. So it's probably going to come down to the Democratic Senate seat in Montana, where John Tester is facing very good, very competitive candidate, and he is at this point trailing. Although one final note is that the Montana Secretary of State just certified last week a question on the statewide ballot in Montana on reproductive rights. So that probably makes that seat even more closely contested than it was before.
Yeah, I mean, I think none of us watching this today or being on this panel will contest that this is going to be a tight race, Tom. I think pretty much we all feel that way. So given the new scenario based on recent polling and, you know, activity on the campaign trail, let's talk about what this all means then for the policy environment, because we have heard a couple things from Vice President Harris and her campaign. One of the things is raising the corporate tax to 28% from the current 21. We've also heard on the other side, President Trump wants to ramp up tariffs on foreign goods. So I know those are just two among a lot of proposals from both candidates, and we'll get to those in a second. But with those two, level set what we expect the policy environment could actually look like with those scenarios.
Right. So if Harris wins in a unified Congress, then yes, the personal tax cuts will be extended only for those lower earners. Biden's proposal, as I think many of our viewers know, was to extend those personal tax cuts that are going to expire at the end of 2025 only for those individuals making $400,000 or less. It could rise a little bit from there. It could rise to $500,000, but in that sense. And I think in a unified Congress, that's what probably will happen. What's interesting, I think control of Congress in this election is going to be critical because we actually have a situation where you've got individual caucus members in both sides of the aisle that are wondering whether or not the corporate tax rate should increase, right? So one of the things that, you know, as you said, Harris is going to propose is raising the corporate tax cuts to 28%, corporate tax rates to 28%. And it may not go that high. You've actually had members of the Freedom Caucus in the Republican Party suggesting that the corporate tax rate could rise a little bit in order to achieve other ends. So how the Congress breaks is going to be an absolutely critical factor. In terms of tariffs, here's a situation where U.S. presidents can more or less act unilaterally. The U.S. Constitution provides that Congress is actually the branch of government whose power over trade is almost exclusive. But in the 1960s and 1970s, Congress, over time, over a period of about 20 years, ceded a lot of authority on trade to the executive branch. And so by the time we actually had President Trump come in for his first term, he had a lot of unilateral authority, as did President Biden in the last 4 years. So if Trump comes in for a second non-consecutive term, you could expect him to basically impose tariffs. He may not do it quite as broadly at the 10% universal, 60% on China that he has advertised. To some degree, that may be a negotiating ploy, but he does have the authority to do it. There's one particular act in 1977, the International Emergency Economic Policy Act, which actually allows him to declare a national emergency and impose a broad tariff. So we can expect that to be high in the agenda for a Trump administration. And again, conversely, if Harris is elected with a unified Democratic Congress, you can see some higher taxation for sure.
Right. Thank you, Tom. And it's something else to go kind of further down the rabbit hole. Some of the other maybe rather unique policy proposals we've heard are actually from both campaigns, Trump and Harris, no tax on tips for service workers. Or there's Harris also is presenting this idea of financial aid for first-time home buyers. Do you think that these are campaign promises? Are they ones that maybe are just being talked about? Could they even see the light of day? What are your thoughts on these types of things?
Yeah, so, you know, we're getting into that season where we get closer to the election and a lot of these proposals start getting rolled out in an event to basically try to gain some ground in the seven swing states that will decide the election. The no tax on tips, initially proposed by Trump, then picked up by Harris. It is bipartisan. You actually had Senator Cruz in the Senate, Republican senator from Texas, actually introducing a bill to this effect. My guess at this point is that it's probably not going to happen after the election for a number of reasons. First of all, it's a big hit on the Treasury, it's a hit on the Treasury when we're trying to basically negotiate a tax bill in 2025. It would help service workers, particularly in Nevada, but there's a degree whether or not it will really affect more than about 4 or 5% of American workers at most. So there's a degree of equity involved as well. And in terms of the fact that the expectation is that, listen, not taxing tips is probably going to be beneficial to those who are making very little in terms of earned income. The problem there is that those individuals who would most likely to benefit probably not the ones basically paying most of the federal taxes. So it becomes a little bit problematic. And then, of course, it's open to abuse, how you classify gratuities as much as anything else. In terms of financial aid to homebuyers, the problem there is you might actually get a counterproductive result. Because if you go ahead and basically provide additional cash incentives to individuals who want to buy their first home, which I'm very sympathetic to conceptually, but the problem there is you're increasing demand for housing without necessarily increasing the supply. So you could get this counterproductive result where you go ahead and juice the market so you actually have more demand for a housing stock that hasn't been increased as a question of policy. Now, Harris did go ahead and basically propose some sensible ideas related to reducing the obstacles for new home construction. That makes a lot of sense. The problem is that's mostly a state and local responsibility rather than a federal one. So again, this is probably another example where I think both parties are, you know, understand that housing is a very big issue in the nation. I think the Democrats realize this is a potential Achilles heel for them, which is one reason that Harris basically proposed that incentive.
Great. Thank you, Tom. One last question for you before we go to Nadia here in the studio with me. And by the way, we are getting questions in from the audience, so we'll ask you to stick around, Tom. Here's like the bottom line. What do you expect could decide the outcome in the final months? We've got about 70 days between now and Election Day. What do you think could decide the outcome as we get up to Election Day in November?
You know, I would say, Anthony, we actually have even less than that because 15 states will begin early voting on by October 9th. So we actually are down to probably about 6 weeks before we actually start having votes cast. I think in terms of what decides presidential elections are always decided on the economy. We actually have numerous instances of polling, which depending on how you ask the question, it can make a difference as to what answer you get. So in 2020, the question was asked by a couple of different polling firms, what's top of mind? Well, of course, top of mind was COVID-19 and the pandemic. And then they asked, well, what's most important in your choice of a president? And the answer was the economy. So I think this week it comes back again to this notion that with very, very few exceptions, the economy is going to dictate the answer. In terms of where that leaves both individual candidates, former President Trump is going to have to basically campaign very hard on the economy and on border control. And you'll expect Vice President Harris to return to a few hot issues, primarily reproductive rights, but also child tax care credits and a few other things like that.
Great, Tom. Thank you very much. A terrific rundown. All right, so we're going to switch over to Nadia here in the studio with me. Nadia, welcome. Lots of content and information that Tom shared with us in the audience. So based on the race dynamics that Tom is talking about, let's talk about how that might look overall and the view that we see on equity markets, particularly, if at all. What could each of these scenarios mean for the markets?
You know, I would say, Anthony, we've been seeing the shift in dynamics within the race, but I can't say that it has had much impact on markets, at least not yet. More recently, the market has been more focused on what's going on with the economy, economic growth, what's going on with the labor market, looking for any sort of signs of slowdown in that, and of course, monetary policy and the Fed. You know, August has been a particularly volatile month due to the fact that we've had a bit of a growth concerns going on. But as we enter the fall, you could see the market starts to shift its attention to these various sort of scenarios that has been put forward in the marketplace. Typically, what you see, though, is in September and October, in any sort of election year, you typically see volatility start to pick up. I mean, we did see right in the days after the late June debate between President Biden and former President Trump, when Biden's performance was not as strong, we did see somewhat of a pickup in a trade victory, a Trump victory trade in terms of, you know, financials and some companies that are more domestically focused catching a bit of a bid. Now, that has since faded as Harris is now at the top of the ticket for the Democrats and has sort of gained momentum within the polls. So when we think about the probability and potential impact for markets, of course, the probability of a Democratic sweep, still while small, as Tom has shown, 15%, it has been gaining and is now a live probability. So that's something worth closely watching, given the implications for a higher corporate tax rate, and that would have implications for market, likely a negative. And then in the probability where Harris wins with a split Congress, we don't think that there will be that much impact to markets, probably a continuous sort of status quo situation. Now, in terms of a red sweep, you know, around that, again, it goes back to what happens around tariffs. We've heard former President Trump talk about increase in tariffs, and so that will have some negative implications for markets as well. And as Tom noted, the president has the power to enact tariffs through executive orders. And so even in a situation where you see former President Trump wins with a mix, a split Congress, there's still that concern of a potential for tariffs. So that's something that we're watching. It could be a mixed bag for the markets in sort of a Trump victory. But again, goes back to the fact that, you know, you talked about earlier about campaign promises and politics. We're watching them, but we're not letting them drive our investment decisions. We prefer to focus on another P. And what I mean by that is profits, corporate profits. Mm-hmm. And we think that that's the key fundamental drivers of markets. And we think that that's what investors should also be focused on.
Right. Plus, also, we have, you know, changed our forecast for what the Fed will be doing as far as cuts are concerned, 100 basis points between September and the end of the year. So that's a shift based on some data that caused some of that volatility that we saw last month. I want to take it, let's break it down a little bit, Nadia, because if you take the two most likely scenarios, which, as Tom mentioned, are Harris with a split Congress and red sweep, mm-hmm. break down some of the individual sectors that could benefit or be, you know, hurt by that. I mean, we're looking at energy, consumer, tech. What would you say are the standouts in either of those scenarios from a sector perspective?
Absolutely. I mean, there will be some, of course, sectors and companies and industries that might be a little bit more sensitive to the election outcome. So let's focus on the Republican sweep, where Tom has provided a 35% probability mm-hmm. to. In that sort of scenario, we know that Republicans tend to focus on deregulation. So that could be deregulation within financials and also within energy. There's also likely to be less focus on antitrust enforcement versus the current administration. So those could be positive things for markets. But then there's also, you know, the focus on higher tariffs and what that could mean for some companies and the overall economy. And so we think that that could be a negative headwind for markets. Now, in terms of sort of the Democrat split with Congress in terms of Harris, again, probably more of a status quo sort of situation. We think that there will be continued support, though, for green energy initiatives as well. I think also going back to the Republican sweep victory, under a Republican, there's likely to be potentially some modification to the Inflation Reduction Act that in terms of rolling back potentially some of those tax credits initiatives around green energy, as well also around manufacturing tax incentives. So again, a mixed bag under Republicans and then sort of under a Democrats, probably more continued support for green energy.
Great. Thank you, Nadia. While we have a second, I just wanted to remind our audience, if you want to ask a question, and we're starting to get some questions here in the studio, just click that Ask a Question button right on your website and we'll get it here. The two T's of this campaign seem to be taxes and tariffs, and Tom mentioned those. Tariffs, obviously, with former President Trump, and we're looking at some tax, especially corporate tax increases for VP Harris and taxes on some wealthier households. How big are the risks of these potentially to the overall equity markets?
Yeah, it's something that's definitely that we're all closely watching. You know, as talked about earlier, we do know, you know, in terms of trade, former President Trump proposing sort of a 10% blanketed tariff on all goods imported to the U.S. It does feel, though, like reality is both administration are focused on tariffs, but what's going to be the key differentiator here is the magnitude of those tariffs, the degrees of those tariffs, and also whether these tariffs are focused and or versus more broad. Under President Trump, it's sort of the view is it's going to be more broad. So 10% potential blanketed tariffs on all imports. I mean, recently in the last couple of weeks, I mean, he's even talked about 10 to 20% broad tariffs. And when you think about how much goods the U.S. imports, that's about $3 trillion of goods coming from overseas. And then he's talked about at least a 60% tariffs on goods coming from China. It's over $400 billion in goods coming from China each year. And so that, again, you know, potential headwinds for those companies that have global supply chains. It has implications for inflation, a potentially higher inflation for the economy, and also potential to slow economic growth. It could shave over a percentage point off of GDP, and that has implications for corporate earnings. I mean, those that are going to feel that headwind, when you talk about it from a sector standpoint, think about consumer discretionary, which I think you alluded to earlier. So retailers, auto manufacturers, also some parts of tech, like tech hardware, as well as semiconductors. And then you have some industrial companies also that could be impacted by this. And then sort of on the other side of this, I mean, some companies that could benefit are those that are more direct competition with China. So think about steel manufacturers, lumber, you know, batteries, solar cell, aluminum could all potentially benefit. But at the same time, you know, when you think about tariffs, I cannot imagine that the U.S. trading partners are going to stand still in all of this. So there's a potential for retaliatory tariffs against U.S. multinational companies as well. Remember, about 40% or so of S&P revenues are coming from overseas. So there's potential for other countries to put tariffs on U.S. Manufacturers as well. And that could end up being leading to a trade war and an overall slowdown in economic growth. And as Tom talked about earlier, the president can't enact this without congressional approval. The other point is in terms of sort of the other T that you talked about in terms of corporate taxes, as noted earlier, Vice President Harris has proposed increasing the statutory corporate rate from 21% to 28%, also proposed increasing the tax on corporate buyback from 1% to 4%. And then you have former President Trump that's actually talked about lowering the corporate tax rate from 21 to as low as 15%, but he's also floated a potential for 20%. So, you know, in terms of where all of that ends up, when you look at the Congressional Budget Office, they've put some estimates out there, Anthony. You know, any sort of, for every 1% change in the corporate tax rate, that can equate to about over $130 billion over a 10-year period. So again, not small peanuts, and that's why corporate tax under unified government will be a big thing to watch. But as we talked about earlier, again, the risk of tariffs is probably higher because that can be controlled by the executive branch through executive order, whereas changes to the corporate tax framework really requires a unified government, which we assign a lower probability to.
Right. Thank you, Nadia. Last question for you before we get to the audience questions. And I think this is something that universally is being discussed. People are very concerned about the uncertainty around the election. Even with some of the polls indicating some gains on the Democratic side, it's still a very, very tight race, and it's anybody's game before we get to, as Tom said, early voting in October. How do you recommend people manage that volatility and kind of avoid some of that downside risk that potentially could be involved in one's portfolio?
You know, Anthony, I have to continue to emphasize, and we all continue to emphasize this, and we don't think that, you know, investors should make any drastic shifts to their portfolio based on the election outcome. Do not change your strategic asset allocation on the accounts for election. But yes, recognize that some investors are a bit concerned, and there are ways to manage some of the risks, and you can do that through hedging strategy by using derivatives, whether that's options or structured products to help mitigate some downside risk. You can do that in terms of capital preservation strategies, as well as yield producing strategies. Also, you know, it might be worth taking a look at the portfolio and seeing where you might have concentrated stock position, particularly in some of the areas that we talked about earlier around tariffs. So think about like consumer discretionary, some of the industrials, or some of even parts of tech that we highlighted earlier that could face, you know, more risk from higher tariffs, and right-size, make the decision on whether you need to right-size those positions or also incorporate some hedge interest strategies to help temper volatilities around those names. But again, no major changes. It's more on the margins of trying to manage the short-term risks around some of these things.
Excellent, Nadia. Right, as we always say on any of the shows we do here, it's always best to have a conversation with your financial advisor because they know your situation individually and they can work with you, as Nadia said, to make sure your portfolio is ready for anything that might happen. Thank you, Nadia. So let's get to some questions. Tom, I'm going to ask you this one, which I'm not surprised to see this one come up. It talks about RFK Jr., and we know now that he has ended his own campaign, is now endorsing former President Trump. So the question is, what impact, if any, does that have on any of these probabilities?
So it's clear, or it's becoming clear, I should say, over the course of the weekend, based on initial polling that came out, these very, very quick polls, that RFK Jr.'s endorsement of Trump has been a positive step for Trump, for Donald Trump. What was interesting about this is that when RFK Jr. hit at the high watermark, which is about 9.5% of the polls, that was at the point, you know, 6-7 weeks ago where Biden was facing Trump. Once Harris became the nominee, his support dropped from 9.5 down to about 5%, 5.2%. So what I think happened there is that a lot of individuals who really were not going to vote for Biden and not for Trump might have been basically doing RFK Jr. as a protest vote. And what's happened since then is those who were going to move back into the Democratic fold have already done so. So now we're basically looking at the amount that could transfer from RFK Jr. into Trump, and you're probably talking somewhere in the neighborhood of 3.5 to 4.5%, something just below 5.2%. That is going to compress the race again. Whether it's enough to basically flip it to give Trump an advantage over Harris right now is questionable, but it is possible. Because remember, you start with the notion that some of those individuals are RFK who haven't already moved to Harris, probably weren't going to vote for Trump anyway. He'll get some of them with the endorsement, but probably not all of them. So Trump probably picks up a couple of points. Now, what that does is it makes those Sun Belt states, Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, North Carolina, more competitive. And you're seeing that in the polls. They're very tight. In some cases, Harris is ahead. Some cases, Trump is ahead, but it's by a narrow margin. In the case of the blue wall of the northern Midwest, whether it's, you know, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, it may have less of an impact up there.
Thank you, Tom. Another question, I'll stay with you. And this is one that that everybody's been talking about, which is this potential from VP Harris about taxing unrealized capital gains in a stock portfolio. It's not a blanket statement. It's not every single unrealized capital gain is going to be taxed. It depends on your situation, your net worth, et cetera. But what are your initial thoughts on that proposal?
I think that's one of the more problematic platforms, policies that Biden had put forth, because there are individuals, centrist Democrats, who are going to have a real problem with that. Not to say that if she has a unified Congress behind her, it won't be put forth. I do think there are priorities that are going to be higher. Raising the corporate tax rate again, maybe not to 28, maybe it's 25 at the end of the day, is one. Extending the personal tax cuts only for those who are earning less than $400,000 or $500,000, absolutely that's a priority. But whether or not we go into taxing unrealized capital gains, it's going to be more problematic from an administrative standpoint. There's a lot of problems with that. And it probably is not going to make the highest priority, even in the case of a unified Democratic Congress behind Harris, which would allow them to do budget reconciliation. Possible, yes, but is it the most probable outcome? I don't think so.
Great. And another one, this is a question that has been asked of former President Trump and VP Harris about the Fed's continued independence as an independent body. And ironically, we just had Rich Clarida here for Road to the Election show. He's a former Federal Reserve vice chair, and I asked him the same question. But I'll ask it of you. Now, we know that Trump has said he would want to get involved in monetary policy decision-making, while Harris has said unequivocally that she would not interfere at all. Could this independence be undermined, is how the question was posed to us here in the room?
I'm skeptical as to whether or not it's going to result in a serious undermining of Fed independence for a couple of reasons. First of all, we should remember this is not new. President Truman made his voice very clear in terms of monetary policy. So did President Johnson. So did President Reagan. So U.S. presidents, not everyone, but U.S. presidents do have a tendency to say, I really care about the economy. I care about some fiscal stimulus and particularly monetary stimulus, which is what the Fed is involved in. And therefore, I want my voice heard. So it's not unprecedented. That's the first issue. The second thing to consider is that it's unclear whether or not a U.S. president can remove a Fed chair for a policy disagreement. You're supposed to, the law, Federal Reserve Act as amended, basically says the chair can be removed for cause. It's never been litigated, and therefore it's an open question. But let's assume for the sake of argument that President Trump could demote Jay Powell into a regular governor position and not make him chair anymore. Keep in mind that while it's by tradition, the Fed chairman of the Board of Governors is also the chair of the Federal Open Market Committee. The Federal Open Market Committee elects its own chair, and they do so every January. So if President Trump were particularly frustrated by whatever policy actions the Fed undertook in 2025 and attempted to demote Powell, it wouldn't necessarily give him the control over monetary policy. And therefore, it probably makes a lot more sense for Trump to jawbone if he disagrees with what the Fed's doing. He'll jawbone, but no question. But it's more likely that he will wait till the spring of 2026 when Powell's term of office as chair of the Board of Governors expires anyway. So the likelihood of, I think, President Trump in a non-consecutive second term coming in and basically saying, I'm going to take control of the monetary policy is probably a bridge too far.
Great. Tom, thank you very much. That is all the time we have. And if we didn't get to your question, we apologize, but we'll make sure we respond to you directly. Thank you for all of you who actually did send your questions in today. And thank you all for joining us. I want to, of course, thank you for spending time with us today. We're looking forward to a strong year of programming ahead from our chief investment office here at UBS. We've got a lot to do between now and the election and even post-election. By the way, the website that you're on right now to watch this video is our Election Watch hub. So make sure you're exploring this site for the most updated scenarios, articles, videos. Our Road to the Election series is there as well. So lots of content, podcasts, etc. Just as another reminder, our next CIO monthly live stream is going to be taking place a week from Thursday, September 5th at 1 p.m. So make sure you're marking your calendars for that. Until then, we're going to continue to keep you posted, as I said, on this website and our other websites as well, with all of the content from our series, videos, podcasts, articles, blogs, and more from my colleagues here at UBS and from our best partners. And as always, we encourage you to continue this conversation with your UBS financial advisor. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Have a great rest of your week and a fantastic Labor Day weekend. We'll see you on Thursday, September 5th. Thanks.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.